also from David Bloom and John Bell on the foundations of quantum mechanics. And be able, in fact, a word that was invented by John Bell in order to denote the things that exist as opposed to the observables, the things that can be observed. And this is somehow the modern word for random variables. And in behavioral quantum theory, we assume that the wave function is not the complete description of the system, but that it has to be supplemented by the variables, the behaviors. And having behaviors is an attempt to solve the measurement problem.
So you're regarding the wave function as separate from the behaviors?
Yes. And so adding behaviors is an attempt to get rid of any distinction of the world between the system and observers on the other end. And in fact, such a theory was proposed in 1927 by De Morel, and it was later redivided by Bohm in 1952, and it's called the pilot wave theory. And it gives the same prediction as the standard interpretation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. But it does not assume any distinction between system and observer. Moreover, it's a deterministic theory, and it's all about particles in motion, particles being guided by the wave function, and the name pilot wave theory. And in fact, John Bell was one of the biggest proponents of the pilot wave theory, if not the biggest. Here is the introduction of a paper written by John Bell. And it says the following: both 1952 papers on quantum mechanics were for me a revelation. The elimination of indeterminism was very striking, but more important, it seemed to me, was the elimination of any need for a big division of the world into system on the one hand and apparatus or observer on the other. And in fact, this is the introduction of a paper that Bell wrote in 1984, which is called Behaviors for Quantum Field Theory, and which will be the main subject of my talk today. And so in that paper, John Bell wanted to show that it was possible to apply the ideas of Bohm, but for fermionic quantum field theories. Indeed, already in 1952, Bohm had applied his own ideas to the case of bosonic quantum field theory. And so John Bell simply wanted to show that it was possible to apply the idea to fermionic quantum field theories too. And he managed somehow to do so, and he obtained a stochastic model that gave the same prediction as the standard interpretation of any fermionic lattice quantum field theory. But there were some basic differences with Bohm's approach for bosonic quantum field theory. Bohm, for instance, took the field to be the behavior. On the other hand, John Bell took point-like behaviors. Bohm's model for bosonic quantum field theory was defined over a continuum, and it was deterministic, whereas Bell's model for fermionic quantum field theory was defined over a lattice and was stochastic. And one quick question you might ask about all these models, all these pilot wave models for quantum field theory, is which one would reduce to the non-relativistic De Morel-Bohm pilot wave theory in the non-relativistic limit. And in that theory, we have point-like behaviors. And so if you want to recover it in the non-relativistic limit, we should also look for point-like behaviors for quantum field theory. And so that's why I will, during the talk, mainly focus on the Bell model, because it uses point-like behaviors. And here I will study various aspects of the Bell model. And here are the contents of the talk. I will first give a brief presentation of the De Morel-Bohm pilot wave theory. Then I will consider the 1984 lattice Bell model. Then I will show that it can be defined directly over a continuum at the limiter zone to be deterministic in that case. And the idea can also be applied, for instance, to QED. And then we obtain a binary interpretation for QED. And after, we discuss super selection rules within the framework of standard quantum field theories and Bohm-Bell quantum field theories. And I will show that in standard quantum field theories, we have to assume the super selection rules, whereas we can derive them in Bohm-Bell quantum field theories. And then I will consider the non-relativistic limit of the continuum Bell model in order to understand whether it reduces to the Bohm-Bell pilot wave theory in the non-relativistic limit. And then I will consider whether these ideas can be applied to bosons too. So are there point-like variables for bosons too? And then I will conclude. So I will start with the presentation of the Bohm-Bell pilot wave theory. Thus, in that theory, if we consider n non-relativistic particles, we assume that these are not only described by their wave function, but also by their position, which are represented by a point in a configuration space of dimension 3n. And position are the behaviors, which mean that they exist at any time, and that they are simply revealed by position measurements. And as far as the equation of motion are concerned, for the wave function, it always evolves according to the Schrödinger equation, thus there is no collapse. And for xt, thus the position of the system in the configuration space, we have the following velocity law. V equal to j divided by rho s, where rho s is the standard probability density to find the system in the configuration x at time t, and j is the associated current through the following continuity equation, which is linked to the fact that the total probability is constant. And there is an important property of that velocity law, which is called equivariance, which means that if we consider many copies of the system with the same wave function, but different realization of the behavior at some initial time t0, then the velocity law automatically ensures that this configuration will be distributed according to psi squared for any later time t. Sorry. And the fact that the configuration are distributed according to the standard probability density for any time t is referred to as quantum equilibrium. And so we still have to show how the prediction of the standard interpretation are reproduced. And so we consider the measurement of an observable A. Just we have a system and an apparatus. And they are described by their wave function, but also by their position. Xs for the position of the system, and x A for the position of the particle from which the apparatus is made of. And so, prior to the measurement, we have that the total wave function, we have that the system and the apparatus are independent. So the wave function is a product of the wave function of the system times the wave function of the apparatus. And so we can decompose the wave function of the system into the eigenstate of the observable A, which is done here. And then the measurement occurs. And the role of the measurement is to correlate the eigenstates An to some position eigenstate of the apparatus phi n. This can be, for instance, a pointer up or a pointer down. And we also have the B states phi n are macroscopically distinct eigenstates, which means that they do not overlap in the configuration space. And so if we compute the total wave function, then we lose any interference effect between the branches. And let us consider, for the sake of simplicity, a two-value measurement. Here we have the branch which corresponds to pointer up, and on the other side we have the branch which corresponds to the pointer down. And we ask in the pilot wave theory, what's the probability, for instance, to see the point of dawn? And this will be equal to the probability for the beable to be in the support of the corresponding branch. But we know that these beables are distributed according to psi squared. Thus, the probability for the beable to be in that branch will be given by the integral of psi squared over that support, thanks to the fact that the configuration are distributed according to psi squared at any time. And thus, we obtain finally for the probability for the beable to be in the corresponding branch, c down squared, which is just the probability given by the standard interpretation.
Should be opposite, right? The xa and xs, they should change place more than b in xs. Because now they're branching in xs.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Just more common.
Okay. And now we still have to show how the wave function appears to be collapsed. And the reason is the following. The velocity of the beable only depends on the value of the wave function at the corresponding point and also on its derivative. And so here we only have the wave function psi down, contribution from the wave function psi down. And thus the velocity law will only depend on psi down, and that other part won't contribute to the velocity law. And so everything would appear just as if that branch would not exist as far as the velocity law is concerned. And this is the effective collapse. Another question is how to apply these ideas to fermionic quantum field theory. And so this is what John Bell wanted to understand in 1984 with the paper Beable for quantum field theory. But he wanted to apply Bohm's program for fermionic quantum field theory. And he considered the universe to be a finite lattice with capital L size. And we denote also the index of a lattice point by small l. And on that lattice, we can define the fermion number lattice operator, FL, which is psi dagger L psi L, where psi is the Dirac field. And if we sum over all the lattice points, then we would get the fermion number. And we can also define the eigenstates of this operator, which are denoted by NQ, where N is a fermion number density configuration, F1, F2, FL, until FL. For instance, in that case, we would have that F1 is equal to 2, F2 is equal to 1, F3 is equal to 2, and so on. And Q are eigenvalues of other observables, such that we have a complete set of commuting observables. And so if we ask what's the probability to find a system in a configuration n at time t, this is given by the following expression. And so up to now, everything was standard. And now come the ideas of John Bell. According to him, the complete description of the system would not only be given by a state psi t, but also by a fermion number density configuration nt. And this NT would be the beable. That means that any measurement of the fermion number density at time T would simply reveal the value of NT here. And here are the equation of motion of the Bell model. For psi T, the deterministic Schrödinger equation is retained. And for the evolution of the fermion number density configuration, we have a stochastic equation of motion, a jump rate, PLMT, which means it is defined as follows. If the system is in the configuration n at time t, there is a certain probability density to jump to another configuration n, and the jump weight is defined to be equal to the right-hand side if this right-hand side is positive. Otherwise, we take it to be equal to zero. And an important property of this jump weight is the same property as in the final wave theory. It's equivariance. It means that the thermal number density configuration are distributed at some initial time t0 according to the standard probability density. Then they would also be distributed according to the standard probability density for any little time t. And this constitutes the Bell model. And now I would like to add one remark about the jump weight. And so we let us start from these initial conditions. Thus we have a state psi t0, and we have a fermion number density configuration nt0. And we assume that this fermion number density configuration contains F fermions. And the pilot state is a more general state. It contains two parts. One part, which is also an eigenstate of the fermion number with eigenvalue F, but it can contain also other parts, which are eigenvalue of the fermion number with eigenvalue which are different from F. And now we compute the jump weight. We start from here. And we have that this eigenstate of the fermion number density contains F fermion, because these are the initial conditions. And since the Hamiltonian commute with the fermion number, here we have no way to jump to another configuration with a different value of the fermion number. And so we know that this fermion number density eigenstate will also contain F fermions. And thus, the scalar product here can only be non-zero with that part of the state. Thus, this part will always give a zero contribution. And we can repeat the argument for any little time. And we see that this part of the state will never contribute to the jump rate. And so we can simply discard it as far as the jump rate are concerned. And this is what I call the Beeble induced super selection. So we have a super selection which is induced by the initial Beeble NT0. And then another remark about the Bell model, which is a remark by John Bell. In fact, he suspected that his model would become deterministic in the continuum limit. He said the following. The stochastic transition probabilities replace here the deterministic guiding equation of the Debreu-Bohm pilot wave theory. The introduction of a stochastic element for Beebles with discrete spectra is unwelcome. For the reversibility of the Schrödinger equation strongly suggests that quantum mechanics is not fundamentally stochastic in nature. However, I suspect that the stochastic element introduced here goes away in some sense in the continuum limit. And so the question is it the case? And so we try to define the continuum Bell model directly from the start. And so if we start with the continuum, instead of having a fermion number and a lattice operator, we would have fermion number density, where psi is the continuum Dirac field. And then the total fermion number would be given by the integral over the tree space of this quantity. And let us remember that in the lattice Bell model, the eigenstate of the fermion number lattice operator were needed. So we will try to obtain the eigenstate of the fermion number density. And from this expression, we know that eigenstate of the fermion number density has positive eigenvalues. And we can also obtain this relation from the canonical anticommutation relation, which means that any of the four operator psi Degger by will create a quantum of the Fermion number at point y. And so if we want to obtain the eigenstates of the Fermion number density, we simply have to start from the state with the lowest Fermion number that I denote by 0f, and we apply various creators psi dagger a k h k on it. So the first step is to obtain the expression of this state. And if we start from the previous expression, and if we obtain the corresponding expression in the momentum space, then we get the following, where C dagger would create an electron, and D dagger would create a positron. And let us just note that creation and annihilation operator are inverted, so there is no normal order product which is implied. And so if we ask what is the state with the lowest fermion number, this would be equal to the positron xc. That is the state in which all the positron states are filled, and in which all the electronic states would be empty. And so it may sound a bit strange that, in fact, the vacuum of the fermion number is full of positrons. And in fact, it's better to use a Dirac prescription, that is to replace the annihilation of a positron by the creation of an electron of negative energy. And if we make this substitution in the following expression, this one, then we simply get that the fermion number is equal to the number of positive energy electrons plus the number of negative energy electrons. And so the state with the lowest fermion number would simply be given by the state which contains no electron of positive energy and no electron of negative energy. Yeah. So here is a picture which summarizes the situation. Thus, on the right, we have the usual point of view in terms of electrons and positrons of positive energy. And on the left, we have Dirac's picture in terms of electrons of positive and negative energy. And so the vacuum of the fermion number is given by the positron xc. And in Dirac's picture, this is equal to the state in which there are no electrons of positive energy and no electrons of negative energy. And now if we ask what's the vacuum, that is the state that does not contain any electron and any positron, then in Dirac's picture, this is equal to the state in which all the negative energy electrons are filled, which is the Dirac state. And now that we have the expression of the state 0f with the lowest fermion number, we can obtain the eigenstate of the fermion number density by applying the creators psi dagger k xk on it. And so we have that a fermion number density configuration is represented by a vector x. And we also have that the probability density to find the system which is described by a state phi in a configuration x is given by the following expression. And this is true when the state phi is a purely fermionic state. And so what I would like to do now is to rewrite, to decompose the Schrödinger equation into a basis which is composed by the eigenstate of the fermion number density. And we will first consider the simplest case, that of the free Dirac quantum field theory. Thus we have the free Dirac Hamiltonian HD. And so we start from the Schrödinger equation. And we know that the Dirac Hamiltonian commutes with the fermion number, which is related to the fact that charge commutes with the Hamiltonian. And so according to the idea of the Biebel-induced superselection, I can take the state psi t to be an eigenstate of the fermion number. And let us simply call the corresponding eigenvalue n. And so we can decompose the state psi t along the eigenstate of the fermion number density with fermion number equal to n. And we obtain the following decomposition. And now, if we substitute this expression into the Schrödinger equation, then we can obtain an equation which is satisfied by the coefficient here. And it can be shown that the equation that we obtain is simply a many-particle Dirac equation. In fact, a n-particle Dirac equation. And if we use also this expression with the previous expression for the probability density to find a system in a given fermion number density configuration x, then we get the probability density to find a system in a fermion number density configuration x is given by this expression, where the psi are the coefficient of the decomposition of psi p into the basis of the fermion number density. And now, if we take the time derivative of this probability density, then it can be shown that it satisfies a continuity equation where the current are the current of the Dirac equation, which are given here. But now, at this point, we have all the ingredients to build a deterministic continuum Bell model. We simply take the complete description of a system to be given by a state psi t, but also by a fermion number density configuration xt. And for the velocity law of xt, we take the velocity to be given by j divided by rho s. And this would ensure that equivariance would be guaranteed. This means that if the fermion number density configuration would be distributed at the initial time according to the standard probability density, then they would be distributed according to the standard probability density for any little time t. And what I will show now is that this construction also works for QED, So we just get quickly through the differences. Thus, we start from the Schrödinger equation, but this time with the QED Hamiltonian. Thus, we have the free Dirac Hamiltonian plus the free photon Hamiltonian and the interaction term. And we still have that the Hamiltonian of QED commutes with the fermion number. So, according to the idea of Biebel-induced superselection, we can take the state psi t to be an eigenstate of the fermion number. And thus, we can decompose the state psi t along the basis formed by the eigenstates of the fermion number density, just as before, except that in this case, we have to include the bosons into the decomposition. And these are represented by the index p, which is, and which basis we are using is not important for the derivation. And now we can do the same as before. We would substitute this expression into the Schrödinger equation, and then we would get a many particle Dirac equation, but this time we get some new terms, which are written in red. And now for the probability density to observe the system in a fermion number density configuration is also the same expression as before, except that we have to sum over all the boson, sum over the trace over the boson. And if we compute the time derivative of this quantity, then it can be shown that the new term won't contribute to the continuity equation. And so we get the same continuity equation as before, except that we sum over the boson into the current. And thus we have all the ingredients to build the continuum Bell model for QED. Just as in the free case, we take the system to be completely described by a state psi p, but also by a fermion number density configuration. And we take the following velocity law for the fermion number density, J divided by rho s, where J is defined here.
So there are no bosonic variables?
No, there is no bosonic variables. We sum over.
And just appearing in the guiding field.
Yes.
And not really there.
Yes. And so now I will just stress some property of the continuum Bell model. The first property is that fermion number density is directly related to the charge density. And so if we say that fermion number density is the Biebel, it is also equivalent to saying that charge density is the Biebel. Second property is that the Bell model is very complex. For instance, if we consider the vacuum state zero, that is the state that doesn't contain any electron and any positron, then we have to view this state as the Dirac C, which is full of electrons of negative energy. And thus there is an infinite number of Biebel associated to the state zero. But this is somehow natural because the state zero is not an eigenstate of the charge density. And so when we perform a charge density measurement over that state zero, then we can in principle observe any charge density configuration with total charge equal to zero. And the Biebel are just there in order to account the charge density that we could observe. So third property is that the Bell model is deterministic. We have a deterministic guiding equation for the fermion number density, and we have the deterministic Schrödinger equation for the private state. Fourth property is that it is in agreement with causality. Commutators of the fermion number density for space-like separated events would commute, and also the velocities which are predicted by the velocity law are subliminal.
Can I ask something?
Yes.
So I understand that just in standard quantum field theory, you get a problem when you localize spectrums and theorems by Hegefeld and others, and you get this superluminal spreading of a state that's initially strictly localized. So, when you say you get subluminal velocities, what do you mean there?
I just mean that.
You mean that velocity?
That velocity is subluminal.
So, what happens to this? I mean, presumably, just looking at the quantum operators, fermion number density operator, you do get this funny business of these superluminal tails spreading.
No, we don't have this.
Well, it may not. Well,
because the difference with the let's say the ideas of Egerfeld is that you start from the vacuum, from the different vacuum. You start from the usual vacuum, which is the vacuum that does not contain any electron and any positron, and here we start with the fermion number vacuum, it can be shown that the difference.
That makes a difference.
Yes. For instance, we can localize one fermion and at a given point, and we would not get the, let's say, the infinite spreading.
Of the spread.
Yes.
I mean, is that something known, or apart from what you've done? I mean, in standard quantum field theory, is it known as a way around? I've never heard of it before.
I think that there is, in one of the papers, figure 7, there is a...
He discussing that.
There is a little paragraph on this.
I see. And it's equivalent to, I mean, again, just from the point of view of standard QED, if you use this other definition for vacuum, mm-hmm. all predictions are the same. It doesn't make any difference.
No, it's, no.
On a related issue, standard Bohm model is profoundly non-local. So, I mean, it seems to me that you say that it goes away in this form.
I'm not saying that there is no.
So, where does it appear, the non-local field?
The non-locality appears here in the fact that a velocity of a particle, if we compute the velocity of a particle at the time t, it would depend on all the position of the particles at that given time t.
Yeah. The commutativity doesn't affect commutativity.
No. But there is a non-locality, but you can use this for, let's say,
the non-locality is hidden in equilibrium. I mean, what I was talking about is even at the quantum level, the way it's often done when people talk about density, fermion density operators, is that they tend to spread superluminal.
No, here there is no the. Now I would like to discuss two of the properties of the Bell model. First, I would like to show that charge superselection rule is a consequence of the Bell model. And then I will try to make the connection between the continuum Bell model and Bohm first quantized and relativistic final question P. Let us try, I will start with the discussion of the superselection rules. And so the idea that I want to give is that in standard quantum field theories, superselection rules must be postulated, and on the other hand, in Bohm-Bell quantum field theories, superselection rules can be derived. And here is the plan of this chapter. I will first define what it means for an observable G to obey a superselection rule. Then I will give a criterion for the existence of a superselection rule in standard quantum field theory. Then I will give another criterion for the existence of a superselection rule in Bohm-Bell quantum field theory. And I will also show that in Bohm-Bell quantum field theory, there is also a second stronger notion of superselection. So let us start with the definition of a superselection rule for an observable G. So we have a state psi t, which evolves according to the Schrödinger equation with the Hamiltonian H until a measurement occurs. And if a measurement occurs, it would collapse. And I will denote the complete set of observables by AJ, and where G is a single dot observable. And so we can decompose the state psi t into a basis which is diagonal with G, and I denote this basis by Gn alpha, where Gn are eigenvalues of G and alpha are other eigenvalues, so that we have a complete set of commuting observables. And here are the coefficients of the decomposition, and I separate the norm from the phase here. And then it is said that G obeys a superselection rule if it's impossible to measure the phase difference phi n alpha minus phi n prime alpha prime, where n prime is different from n. And this means that the state would just behave as a statistical mixture of eigenstate of G. And now let us try to obtain a criterion for the existence of a superselection rule for G in standard quantum field theory. And so if we would like to measure the phase difference phi n alpha minus phi n prime alpha prime, we would have to make the branches with different eigenvalue of G interfield. And this can be done in two ways, either through the Schrödinger evolution, either through the collapse with the measurement of some observable AK. And so if all observables of the theory, including the Hamiltonian, commute with G, then there would be no way to make branches with different eigenvalue of G interfield. And so there is no way to measure this phase difference. And then G would obey a superselection rule. And the consequence of this criterion is that some Hermitian operators cannot be observable. For instance, the following operator is Hermitian, but it does not commute with the charge operator. And since a charge is superselected, then this cannot be an observable. But if we don't know the superselection rules, then we have no way to construct the complete set of observables from scratch. And so, since we cannot determine this complete set of observables, we have no way to say if an observable G would commute with all observables of the theory. And so this criterion gives us no way to predict if G is superselected or not. And now the situation is a bit different in Bohm-Bell quantum field theories, because there are only two ways to act on a state. Thus, there is the Schrödinger evolution, and there is the measurement. But the measurement is always done into some preferred behavioral basis B. And so if the behavior B commutes with G, and if G commutes with the Hamiltonian, then G will simply obey a superselection rule. And for instance, in the Bell model, we know that the behavior is the Fermion number density, psi dega x psi x. And we know that charge commutes with the Hamiltonian, and that charge commutes with the Fermion number density. And so we can predict the charge is superselected. And for instance, if we would use the same argument for the total energy, then we would see that total energy will not be superselected. And in Bohm-Bell quantum field theories, there is also a stronger notion of superselection. And the concept is defined in the following way. An observable G is said to be strongly superselected if the trajectories of the particle are unchanged when we replace the state psi p by the corresponding statistical mixture of eigenstate of G. And we can also obtain a criterion for determining whether an observable G is strongly superselected or not. And the criterion is the following. If the observable G is a function of the behavior, and if G commutes with the Hamiltonian, then G is strongly superselected. And for instance, in the Bell model, charge is strongly superselected. And this idea of strong superselection rule is just what I call Veable-induced superselection rule when I presented the lipid Bell model. So let me summarize this point. So in the standard quantum field theory, G would obey superselection rules if G commutes with all observables of the theory. We have no way to decide to construct this set of observables. Thus, we cannot predict if an observable G is superselected or not. In Veable quantum field theory, the situation is different because there is only one preferred Veable basis for the measurement. And so G would be a superselection rule if G commutes with the Hamiltonian and G commutes with the Veable. And so here we can derive the superselection rules rather than postulate them. And also in Veable quantum field theory, there is this second, stronger notion of superselection. And in fact, this notion of strong superselection rule can be used as a guide in order to choose the correct Veable. For instance, if we would take, we know that lepton number is superselected, well, just as the baryon number is a charge, these are the superselection rules which are known. And if we would take lepton number density as a Veable, then we would automatically get lepton number superselection rule as a consequence. And in fact, for the standard electroweak model, it's possible to build the deterministic Bell model by taking the lepton number density as the Veable. And then we automatically get a superselection rule of the lepton number. And now I will discuss the non-relativistic limit of the continuum Bell model in order to understand whether we recover the non-relativistic de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory in that limit. And so I will consider the simplest case, that of a free electron. And so we have our two models, the continuum Bell model on the left, and both non-relativistic pilot wave theory on the right. And in the continuum Bell model, an electron is pictured as the Dirac C being filled plus an electron of positive energy. Thus, in that case, for a single electron, we have an infinite number of Veables. And on the other hand, in both non-relativistic pilot wave theory, there are no negative energy electrons, and we only have one positive energy electron. And thus, there is only one Veable in that case. And so we see that the number of Veables differ. And so the question is how to make the link between these two theories. The first question that we might ask is, do we see the Dirac C? And in fact, if we have a one electron state, that is one electron, no positron, then this state cannot be an eigenstate of the charge density. And so if we make charge density measurements, then we can, in principle, observe any charge density configuration with total charge equal to minus E. And for example, here are four possible measurements of the charge density. And among these four measurements, only one corresponds to the situation that we have in the non-relativistic pilot wave theory. And so the question is how to get rid of this. The first thing that must be stressed is that we are interested in the non-relativistic limit. So if we want to remain within the non-relativistic regime, we should ensure that when we look at the particle, only momenta with a norm much smaller than the particle are transferred to this particle. And this means that measurement should be done, but with the position uncertainties, with position uncertainties which are much greater than the quantum wave range. And that means that we cannot perform a measurement of the charge density at a single point x, but that we have to consider the closed grain charge density, which is defined as the convolution of the charge density with some profile G. And for instance, G could be a Gaussian with a width which is much larger than the quantum wave range. But in the ideal situation, we would have that the closed grain charge density would then commute with the particle number. And then the usual vacuum would become an eigenstate of the closed grain charge density. And this means that the vacuum zero has only support on charge density configuration, which cannot be distinguished from zero after closed grain. And in the same way, the state psi beta ax applied on the vacuum zero would become eigenstate of the closed grain charge density. For instance, if we have a detector with a profile G, which is centered at the point Y, then psi beta ax would become an eigenstate of the closed grain charge density with eigenvalue minus E if X is within the detector. And the one electron state is a superposition of such states, which means that now if we make a measurement of the closed grain charge density, then we can only see one minus in one of the closed grain charge density detectors. I will explain the situation with the drawing. Thus, at the start, we have a one electron state, and we make charge density measurement with tiny detectors, and we can, in principle, observe any charge density configuration. But as the size of the detectors grow, then some configuration tend to be equal. And finally, when the size of the detectors are sufficiently big, then we only see one minus in one of the detectors. Thus, we know that with these closed grain charge density detectors, we will only see one minus in one of these detectors. And so we can ask, what's the probability density to find a charge minus E in one of the detectors? And this is given by the following expression, where psi, where the coefficient of the decomposition is. But now this means that everything happens as if the non-relativistic electron would be disentangled from the electrons of the Dirac C. Indeed, if we consider the complete system, the Dirac C plus the electron, and if we take a product wave function, thus a wave function for the non-relativistic electron and a wave function for the Dirac C, and if we compute the probability density to observe a definite Fermion number density configuration, then we see that the contribution from the non-relativistic electron and the contribution from the Dirac C would factorize. And for the Dirac C, we know that when we perform a closed grain charge density measurement, we can only see zero. Thus, this part would not contribute, and then we get an expression which is the same as before. And now we compute the Bohmian velocity law starting from this expression. And it can be shown that the electrons of the Dirac chain would only be guided by the wave function of the Dirac chain. So the part of the free electron just cancelled. And all these electrons of the Dirac chain, we do not see them when we perform closed grain charges in measurement. And on the other end, the one electron would only be guided by the wave function, by the non-relativistic wave function. Then when we compute the velocity of this electron, we can see that the contribution of the Dirac chain simply disappears. And then we remain with the usual Bohmian velocity law, which reduces to the Bohmian velocity law of the non-relativistic pilot wave theory in the non-relativistic limit. Well, this is a small drawing. So this is the, at the start, we can in principle observe any charge density configuration when we have tiny detectors. And when the detectors grow, when the size of the detectors grow, we can only see one minus, which follows a Bohm trajectory. And now we'll consider whether the Bell model can be applied to bosons. So are the point like variables for bosons too? And the simplest case to consider is the case of the Klein-Gordon equation, which describes a charged particle of mass mu. And in that case, we have a conserved current, but the problem is that the density may be negative. And so we cannot interpret it as a probability density. And this already occurs for superposition of positive energy solutions. It is not a problem which is related to simply to negative energies. But of course, if we have a superposition of positive energy solution, then we may have that the density is negative at some places, but when we integrate it over all space, then we get a positive result. And so the idea is that it may not be meaningful to try to localize a boson in an arbitrary small region. For instance, if we would look at a boson with wavelengths which are much smaller than the Compton wavelength, then this would lead to particle production, and then we would end up in a sector with a different particle number, which is not what we want. And so we should look at the bosons with position uncertainties which are much greater than the Compton wavelength. And this means that we cannot consider the Klein-Gordon density, but that we must consider the closed grain Klein-Gordon density, which is defined as the convolution of the Klein-Gordon density with some profile H, which could be, for instance, a Gaussian with a width which is much larger than the Compton wavelength. And if we start from this closed grain density, it's possible to show that it still satisfies the continuity equation. And so, if we have that the closed grain Klein-Gordon density is positive, we could do a Bohm's interpretation by taking the velocity of the particle to be given by the closed grain Klein-Gordon current divided by the closed grain Klein-Gordon density. So we simply show an example of the application of this idea, and then I will consider whether this relation is satisfied or not. So let us start with the example. We work in a one dimensional space, and we take the mass of the boson to be given by one, and we also work with natural units. And so we take a superposition of two positive energy solutions, one with energy equal to 1, and the other with energy equal to 5. And if we compute the Clangerdon density for this superposition, then we get the continuous curve, and we see that the continuous curve may be negative. And on the other end, if we coarse grain the Clangerdon density with a coarse graining parameter which is equal to 1, then we get a positive coarse grain Clangerdon density. Another problem related to the fact that the density may be negative is the fact that the Bohmian velocities can be superliminal. For instance, if we would define the velocity of the Clangerdon boson to be given by the Clangerdon current divided by the Clangerdon density, then we would end up with superluminal Bohmian velocities. And on the other end, if we define the velocity of the Clangerdon boson to be given by the coarse grain Clangerdon current divided by the coarse grain Clangerdon density, then we get subliminal coarse grain Bohmian velocity. Well, this is the idea. And now, what we should finally consider is whether this relation satisfies or not. Whether do we have that the coarse grain Clangerdon density is positive or a sufficiently large coarse graining parameter. And so we can start, in order to determine whether this is the case or not, we can start from the expression of the coarse grain Clangerdon density. And we take psi to be given by a superposition of positive energy solution. And we express the profile H in terms of its Fourier transform. And thus we end up with the following expression. But if we have a profile H which is, for instance, a Gaussian with a width which is much larger than the Compton wavelength, then its Fourier transform would have a width which would be much smaller than the mass of the particle. And then it's natural to make a Taylor expansion of this quantity around norm of Q equal to 0. And if we perform this Taylor expansion, then we get that the coarse grain Clangerdon density is equal to the coarse grain Newton-Wigner density at the first order. But the Newton-Wigner density is known to be positive. So we would like to understand how good is the agreement between the coarse grain Clangerdon density and the coarse grain Newton-Wigner density. And in fact, it's possible to give a bound on the difference between the coarse grain Clangerdon density and the coarse grain Newton-Wigner density. And this bound is given by the following expression. If H is the following Gaussian with a width delta, which is much larger than a Compton wavelength. And from this, we can obtain a bound on the probability of the defined in the Clangerdon wave, and we end up with the following: if the probability to find a Clangerdon particle is negative, then it should be much smaller than this quantity. Thus, it should be much smaller than the Compton wavelength divided by the size of the detector. But this shows that if we increase the size of the detector, then we diminish the probability to get a negative Langevin density.
Sorry, what is mu? Is that mass? Mu?
Yes.
Is that mass?
Yes, yeah. It's a mass. It's a mass of the Langevin boson. And so we show finally that negativity of the Langevin density tends to vanish as the size of the detector grows. So this is something which is related only to small regions. Now I come to the conclusion. Thus, I have first shown that it was possible to build a continuum Bell model, that this continuum Bell model was deterministic and related to a C interpretation. I have also shown that the ideas could be applied to QED. I have discussed super selection rules within the framework of standard quantum field theories and Baumbell quantum field theories. And then I have shown that super selection rules could be derived in Baumbell quantum field theory, whereas they have to be postulated in standard quantum field theory. I have also shown that in the non-relativistic limit, there is a strong indication that we recover Bohm's non-relativistic pilot wave theory if we use viscous grating. And for the Bell model for boson, I have this proposed solution, interpretation to the coarse grating Langevin density. And here are just some reference of the paper which deal with the behavioral interpretation of quantum field theories.
You're not obliged to use boson vehicle. You could just say that fermions, yes. Description of vehicles, and bosonic degree of freedom just appear in the wave function.
Yes.
Okay, so you could do that. But if you do, but this thing about if you do introduce vehicle to bosons, I'm not sure if I understood. You're saying that this problem with the negativity of the density. The negativity diminishes as the coarse grating region goes up.
Yes.
But I mean, isn't it the case that no matter how small the negativity is, you're talking about negative probability, negative density, negative number density, it's surely conceptually unacceptable no matter how small the negativity is. So.
No, but the idea was that at some, if we the size of the detectors would grow sufficiently enough, there would be some stage in which we would get up rid of the negative density in all cases.
Yeah.
Yes.
But so did you strictly show that or?
No. There is only
that's what you're hoping. Yeah.
Yes, I'm hoping for this. Yes.
I mean what would be wrong with just taking the fermion as
viable? We could take only fermions as viable, it could be but it was just to try to see whether we could get something with the idea of.
The second question there. So if you would you use this coarse grain vehicles then? I mean, so they could hardly give something fundamental. And I mean, there it doesn't give a very fundamental touch to it if they sort of coarse grain things.
So yes, but
you will have to have a. Some quantum wavelength description also, if there's supposed to be something fundamental about this.
Yes, but I think that particle localization does not make sense at any scale.
So
I just wanted to obtain an interpretation, a Bohmian interpretation, where we have a standard interpretation, where the standard interpretation is valid.
In standard quantum field theory, there are strong arguments by some and collaborators that there are no such thing as super selection rules. And this is goes against the Wigner collaborators. The idea behind that is that there are only effective super selection rules. What we consider super selection rules, like white connections or whatever, they come about because of decoherence events. So, and there are very strong arguments, and I tend to agree with that. Now, the question is that you have actually derived super selection rules. That seems to me introduces an element which is not there.
You mean the fact that super selection rules have to be postulated?
Well, impossible. In axiomatic quantum field theory, you know impossible. But if you look at strictly from quantum mechanical point of view, there are very strong arguments to suggest that there are no such thing as super selection rules. So what we consider as super selection rules are effectively super selection rules, which come about because of recurrence effects. So what I'm saying is that having derived super selection seems to me introducing an element.
Yes.
You're saying that in principle, in standard quantum field theory, there could be a breaking of the super selection rules if it wasn't for environmental.
Well, that's actually looking the other way around. There are breaking comes about because you postulate something which is actually separately existing to the problem, then you can break it. But what our own company are arguing is that this is a long way to look for it. And these super selection rules are affecting effects, comes about because of the gross effects.
Well, but you cannot only be the gross effects because they come about because of the only. Cannot perform certain operations in your system, right?
Yeah, you can show that all of these operations involve some sort of experimental procedures in which some effects are ignored in the coherence fashion. These are the arguments which I think the debate goes back and forth, yes. So, my subject. So, what would you say to that? I mean, doesn't it introduce some element which is just not bad?
No, but. Well, the fact that super selection rules are derived from the Bell model, you cannot do anything about it. This is a consequence.
It's a derivation of
this. Yes. Okay. This is not something I'm introducing. It's a consequence of the Bell model.
Yeah, so I mean, my suggestion was the Bell model is introducing something which is not there.
Yeah. So, in a sense, rather than saying it's an advantage, see the disadvantage that in order to be able to set up a Bell model, there has to exist something which is super selective, otherwise you can't find your vehicles. So depending on your point of view, that would be a disadvantage.
I find it could be let's say an advantage in the sense that it's more it gives more predictive power to the behavior to Gombel quantum field theory. It gives a prediction which can be verified, tested. Of course, if we see that the charge doesn't obey a super selection rule, then the Bell model is out of the game.
So, to what extent is it
really
a prediction?
I mean,
isn't it almost put in by hand anyway?
No.
Just a selection of your vehicle. I mean, by restricting the possible configuration state, I mean, the dynamics doesn't allow for.
No, the dynamics, but if you start from a sector of. Let's say when you don't have a number, then you stay within that sector.
But isn't that essentially, that's not something which is a derived fact of the theory, it's pretty much put in by hand. The equations you admit in the first place necessarily imply that property.
Yes, the equation of the Bell model implies this. Yes.
It's not some subtle property, it's quite a real property of the way the formula is set up.
But that's also just on the quantum mechanical side of it. You don't need any labels for that. I mean, if you have a state, you have a certain amount of particles, you have a certain periodic density, and then it will stay like that, and that's just a property of the Hamiltonian.
Yes, but you could start from a...
Yeah.
It's kind of like the arguments in the coherence choices. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a similar. It's kind of similar to the argument that it's a decoherence.
Any more questions or points? Let's spend some of the